right here in Kingston, Ontario, or CFRC.ca, listening in from anywhere in the world. My name is Rue. I'm the host of the CFRC Live Sessions, a show where we bring you performances recorded by artists from Kingston and beyond, right here in CFRC Studio A. Today, the 10th of July, kicks off the first day of Ottawa Blues Fest, the renowned rock, blues, pop festival that happens out in Ottawa, and quite a few Kingston artists are playing this year's edition. So if you go down to the festival tomorrow, Friday, the 11th of July, you can see Emily Steele and The Deal performing. Tiny Horse, a band who have been on this show before, are playing a free outdoor show at Blues Fest on Sunday, the 13th of July. They also have a music video for their latest single, Islands, that's dropped out just today. If you go on Wednesday the 16th next week, you can see Kingston Rockers Luscious playing. Hellhound Trail are playing on the 19th, that's Saturday. And our guest for today's show, Nolan Hubbard, who joined us way back in February on a blustery, snowy day to talk about his music. He's going to be playing on the Sunday the 20th, and he's currently working on his second album, so you'll hear him talking a little bit about that as well. You can find his music at nolanhubbard.com, and you can find this show on Instagram at the handle CFRC Live Sessions, where follow us, check out the stuff we're doing, but also if you want to get in touch, you can send us a message there or email livesessions@cfrc.ca. Here comes Nolan. Enjoy the show. Good morning, everyone. You're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca. It is 11 a.m. and you're listening to the CFRC Live Sessions, where every week we have a new guest in the studio joining us in here, Studio A, at the station to play some music for us and just to talk about music. And I'm very happy that we have a guest today joining us. Hello, Nolan.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
Very pleased that you've taken out the time in the snow to come and talk to us.
Yes, we almost had to climb a mountain to get into the studio today.
Mm-hmm, 12 feet tall.
Truly.
Mount CFRC is what they used to call it.
I think so, yeah. I heard about that one.
Well, let's introduce you to our listeners who might be, you know, hearing about you and your music for the first time.
Yeah, so my name is Nolan Hubbard. I grew up in the little town of Gananoque, just down the road. And I live here in Kingston now. I went to high school in Kingston, so even though Gananoque is truly my home, Kingston has always felt like home for me. I'm 28 years old now, and I've been, making music for 10 years. I've been touring around Canada, playing my music, releasing music, and producing music for about 10 years now, and I'm super excited about some of the new projects I got going on and some of the songs I'm playing here today.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about all of those, but for people who've never heard your music before, I would say from listening to you playing here today and like generally listening to your music, I'm getting lots of kind of cool indie pop vibes, you know, really wonderfully layered and produced stuff. I guess that's how I would describe it to people. Talk influences to me. So like, where's all this coming from?
Totally. For years, I was very kind of stripped back in how I presented my music and how I played my music live.
Very singer-songwriter.
Very singer-songwriter. So I was always a huge fan of the Jack Johnsons of the world, the John Mayers, Jason Mraz. I always say the three J's. But those were, you know, some of my absolute idols and still very much our biggest inspirations when it comes to songwriting. And
what made you want to, you know, add a bit more to it?
That was exactly it. At some point, I realized that a lot of what I listen to in the car is slightly more pop-based, more indie rock, more, I like a lot of shoegaze kind of stuff. So I think that it all kind of culminated into what a lot of people are calling, and I guess what my friends call it, and what I've started to call it is bedroom pop. And,
right.
Yeah, I think it's just a combination of taking those singer-songwriter ideas and those songs that I write and putting a kind of cool vibe to it, a unique vibe to it that, you know, I could bump my head to in the car kind of thing.
Yeah. And like the thing, when I hear your music, I'm hearing not just those bedroom vibes, but also it's like it would work really well at a place like Miziki Cafe or something as well. Like it's also kind of like acoustic, folky, lounge stuff.
It's actually always been a little tough for me to pinpoint a genre because I'm such a big appreciator of music. So there's part of me that will write a song just at the campfire with me and the acoustic, but there's also a part of me that loves to get into a studio and have tools like a, you know, a bass and a synth and these kind of things to really make a cool sound. So I have to kind of suppress my appetite for all the music sometimes and try to focus it a little bit. But yeah, definitely I still like to pay homage to the, you know, my roots as a singer-songwriter.
Yeah. And you said that you've been, you know, playing music around town in Kingston with a lot of artists as well. So what has your experience of the Kingston music scene been like?
It's always been a, like, I will promote Kingston probably till the day I die, because Kingston is an incredible place for a musician to be. There's always been a lot of support around the community. Like you mentioned, Musiki, that's one of my absolute favorite places to play. And I think I play there coming up in 2 weeks from now. But yeah, I love the community here. I've lived in Toronto for, you know, small periods of my life, and there's a lot of exciting things going on in Toronto. But in terms of a musician like myself who, and a person like myself who loves to be around community and loves to share music, Kingston is an incredible place to be. There's a lot of great artists here, a lot of great bands, and I've been fortunate enough to, you know, work with some of those bands on making music, play with some of those bands, and I would happily recommend to anybody starting out in music that Kingston is a good place to do it.
And you mentioned the community and like how people kind of, you know, work together and all of that. Have you like worked with Kingston musicians before, played in bands with them?
Yeah, I've worked with a number of solo artists. Right now I'm writing music with a good friend, Matt Bazinet. He's an awesome singer-songwriter who's releasing some music and seeing some success on the streaming platforms and that kind of thing. Recently I did a song collaboration with my good friends, the Healy Brothers, and I'm also helping them produce some of their music and playing guitar in their band. And I'm just love those guys. They're a whole lot of fun, and it's been a really kind of co-motivational thing. It's really made me get inspired in my own music again, being able to be a part of those kind of projects. So a couple years ago I was writing with Devin Cole. She's done incredible things in the music industry in these past couple years, and we met here in Kingston. So I, you know, there's always been cool people for me to make music with around, and you know, thankfully they've let me.
Yeah, totally. So many wonderful musicians. But let's jump into your first song. So what's the first track you're going to play us? And tell us a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So this is a song that came out on my EP that released just this past fall. It came out in November of 24. And it's a song called How I Feel. It was actually the first single off this little EP. And this one very much goes back to those folk singer-songwriter kind of roots. And I think I maybe gave it a little bit more of the bedroom pop spin in terms of the production of the drums and that kind of thing, where it feels a little bit more straight down the middle and something that you could tap your foot to and bob your head to. But at the same time, I kind of let myself just be a guitar player on this one. And the song itself is kind of just about, a lot of my songs are about growing up or growing as a person and that kind of thing. And this was a song that I wrote about kind of my simple upbringing and kind of how, you know, growing up in my family and, my parents are still together and very much are, it's almost gross sometimes how much how much love is in the house and that kind of stuff. But it was kind of a note to myself saying that that's always kind of been the dream for me. I'm a pretty traditionalist guy, and you know, the dating scene these days and that kind of thing. And this song was just me kind of saying, you know what, that's just how I feel, and that's a-okay, you know.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk all about situationships when we're back. No, we won't. But yeah, totally. Like, this definitely fits the kind of storytelling vibe that folk songwriting has provided a lot of, you know, singers, songwriters. So I feel like it's a perfect genre to take this song in. So let's listen to it right now.
fresh encounter. 'Cause I grew up watching mom and dad doing just fine. Mismatched my kitchen dancing on lay. Now I'm a sucker 'cause I'm pictured every time. Put my cards in your hands on the table, 'cause I fall hard. Got some scars that I'll never forget, 'cause you just are exactly what I think they meant. So if you go far, well, I'll build a rocket, some kind of jet. 'Cause I'm in love with someone who's better than me, and I know it ain't how it goes, it's just how it seems. Still I hold her like I'm even though she don't ask as much, it's just how I feel. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
My song called How I Feel, and it's off my EP that just came out called I Won't Lie.
We're here with Nolan Hubbard here on CFRC Live Sessions, where we bring you great new music, and we also talk about a lot of cool music. So Nolan's been telling us about your EP, about the music you write, about your influences. I've also noticed that, like, you're really involved in a very DIY way in the music that you make. Like, you produce your own music, you produce your music videos and everything. So it's like, do you kind of start your music with this creative, like, a full creative vision that you're going to have this music and, like, the music videos are going to look like this, all of that? Walk me through it a bit.
Totally. I think it's really been something that came to fruition, I suppose, in the last 2 years or so. I'm 28 now, and I've made music since I was 18. And when I was 18, I was really fortunate to get an opportunity to go down to Nashville and make a record down there. And I was working with a producer named Doug Romano, and that was a really cool experience. But I think the thing that my heart was missing when I did that, the only thing, because it was an incredible experience, and I'm very grateful to have learned everything I did from all those people. But I think a little part of my heart was missing, you know, being more a part of the vision. Mm-hmm. And I think over the, you know, the past 10 years at this point, it's been, my goal is to, you know, really, really take these ideas I have in my head and bring them to life. And it's taken a lot of learning of new skills, like, you know, learning how to make these music videos that I've made in the past couple of months was a really cool part of me putting a picture to the music. And I've always had that vision in my mind when I write the music, when I create it. And
it's almost like you put a context and a situation to the music.
Totally. And I think it resonates with the listeners as well, is what I've been feeling and hearing. And I think we can all think of some of our favorite artists, and you think of, you know, your favorite music video by them or something, or you think of your favorite cover for their album or whatnot.
Iconic visuals.
Yeah, and I think it's really inspired me is being more a part of that part of the process and not just kind of offloading it. I love collaborating with people, and I always will, but at the same time, very, very proud of the fact that I'm able to kind of create those visions start to finish on my own. And, the quality might suffer at certain points, but I think the spirit kind of lives through that.
Mm-hmm. You stick to your true vision.
Exactly. And it feels good.
Mm-hmm. Although we brushed past Nashville really quickly, that's, you know, because that is the kind of mecca for guitarists, really.
Absolutely.
So tell me a bit more about that.
It was a really cool experience. I went down, I had just moved to Toronto when I was 18, and I was, you know, chasing this music dream that I've been so lucky to chase. And I met this producer, Doug Romano, and he was working with a lot of songwriters, a lot of session musicians, both in LA and Nashville at the time. And he said, you know, if you're committed to this and you want to do it, well, let's go to Nashville and make it happen. So I went down for 2 weeks. It was interesting. You know, there's a little part of me that learned that, okay, maybe I want to go that more DIY route. You know, costs a lot of money to hop on a plane kind of thing. But at the same time, I would not be the musician I am today if I didn't get to be around that when I was that young. Because they're just absolute pros down there. And it
is very industry-like down there, though, isn't it? Like, it's such an established, you know, this is where music happens. You've got all these avenues set up. And I guess there isn't a lot of room for experimentation then.
And that's, I'm super grateful for that, because it taught me a very specific appreciation for this craft and treating myself like a professional.
Mm-hmm. You learn a little bit of everything and kind of just choose what you want to take going forward.
Found which lane. I wouldn't know which lane I wanted to be in if I didn't go and try that lane. And I think it is a rigid lane, and I think people can get kind of swept up in you're supposed to do this and that kind of thing. And to be honest, for a couple of years, you know, I maybe held myself back a little bit by getting stuck in those kind of thoughts. But if you can appreciate the level that they're doing it at, take the important parts for yourself, because everybody who makes art, has maybe a different goal and different ways of expressing themselves. So I just kind of found what worked for me by seeing all of it.
Yeah. So we'll move on and we'll play one more song. Your second song is one that isn't actually out yet.
Yeah, this is a brand new unreleased song. It's called Stems. And I was saying earlier that a lot of my songs are about growth. This one is no different at all. But when I wrote this one, it kind of floored me a little bit. And I said, wow, I'm really inspired to get back into doing stuff like this, like connecting with stations like this and getting my music out there into the world. And yeah, it's a song called Stems, and it's probably one of my favorite things I've ever written, and excited to share it with the world this year.
Okay, well, let's listen to a preview, a version of it live right now on C4C.
this master, but it goes around again. And now I know just where I've been. Stems get stronger as they grow taller. Maybe I'm just the same.
My name is Nolan Hubbard, and you just heard my song Stems, which is coming out sometime this spring.
So welcome back. You're listening to the CFRC Live Sessions. I'm your host, Rue, and Nolan's joining us today, talking to us about music, playing us some lovely stuff. So let's just talk about live shows a little bit.
Totally. I've been playing live. I've played about 1,100 shows in my lifetime at this point.
That's a huge number.
It is a pretty...
That's a professional number.
It's a pretty daunting number. When I think about it, I feel very, very fortunate.
Any other shows coming up that you also want to tell us about?
I've got some more shows on my website that you can definitely go check out at any point, just nolanhubbard.com. But I've also got a show coming up this week with my good friends, the Healy Brothers. I was mentioning musicians playing with in town, and I've been fortunate enough to be playing guitar for them for the past couple weeks. And we've got an exciting show coming up, a little bit of a bittersweet one. We're playing at the Mansion with the Backsteps for their final show.
The farewell show,
and they will be dearly, dearly missed. But
totally, and musically as well. You did say that you've got one single coming out in a couple of weeks' time, on the 14th of March.
I got a song coming out on March 14th called Touch, and it's one of my favorite things I've written. It's something I can kind of dance to. I'm excited. I'm going to go shoot a music video for it next week. So,
maybe we'll see you around town shooting the music video.
Absolutely. If you see me dancing, then come say hey. And
Well, lovely. We will probably see you downtown, you know. Like, I feel like downtown is like the spot for music videos at the moment. I've seen a few Kingston videos, and then it's like that moment where you see it in the video on YouTube or like on a big screen, and you're like, oh, I know where that
is. Wait a minute, I saw that the other day.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, absolutely. I love Kingston, and I always will, and I'll always, you know, do little nods to it in my art for sure.
Mm-hmm. And you're also going to be playing us the song Touch right now, aren't you? The final song.
I am, and I'm super excited to put this one out next month. So if you like this one, then go stream it, go pre-save it, all that good stuff.
Nolan, thanks so much for joining us today on the show. It's been such a fun time having you in here, listening to your tunes, talking to you, and we hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, and we will see you guys very soon. Touch.
It feels like you never lift me up. I think for a while and that get me stuck. But now I'm alive and I can feel that rush. Finding my stride, I'll never lose that touch. Yeah. Tearing me down, still I play cool. But I'm getting tired of playing fool. You never treat me right, it's sort of feeling like I'm getting jealous vibes, but I'm not the fighting type. Can't look me in the eye, you hardly even try. It's time to say goodbye, 'cause it feels like you never lift me up. I think for a while and that get me stuck. But now I'm alive and I can feel that rush. Finding my stride, I'll never lose that touch. Yeah. Sort of feeling like I'm getting jealous vibes, but I'm not the fighting type. Can't look me in the eye, you hardly even try. It's time to say goodbye, 'cause it feels like you never lift me up. Think for a while and let that get me stuck. But now I'm alive and I can feel that rush. Finding my stride, I'll never lose that touch.
Hey, my name's Nolan Hubbard, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9.
Hello to all of you, and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. From riot to parade, protesters say Toronto Pride has lost its way.
The corporate pride that dominates the streets of Toronto every year has, I think, completely lost the focus of what Pride began as, which was a riot against policing.
New Brunswick Premier Holt and Tourism Minister Thériault take the scenic route on a fact-finding mission to Murray Beach and Baie Verte.
We're listening closely to the people of the region tell us what is their priority, and that influences what we do next.
We can see the province from our own eyes.
deplatform Pilsner comes to life as BC's public transit experiments new funding models.
We're always trying to think of new ways, creative ways to generate a little bit of revenue. I think the first of its kind program, not just in Canada, but possibly in North America, when you think about a transit agency doing something like this.
We'll meet up with a group of bat watchers in Montreal.
We've mainly seen big brown bats, silver-haired bats, and hoary bats. Sometimes a tricolored bat will appear.
And do you wonder what goes on in a fire station? We're touring one in Winnipeg with Ryan Funk.
Our interest with this facility is also to be a part of the community, to be an inviting space.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next half hour as we travel to Burnaby, BC, Montreal, Quebec, Sackville, New Brunswick, Toronto, Ontario, and Winnipeg, Manitoba this week. Our first stop will be out east in the Maritimes to meet up with New Brunswick Premier Susan Holt and Tourism Minister Isabelle Thériault. They were both on a fact-finding mission last week, getting some input from locals, business owners, and tourists as well. On Wednesday, June 25th, Holt and Thériault visited a number of spots in the southeast of the province, including Murray Beach Provincial Park, where Holt got an earful from people talking about transportation and infrastructure issues in that rural area. Journalist Erica Butler caught up with the political pair at Bistro Le Chableur, Blue Cat, in Bay Verte, Green Bay, and started by asking them about their itinerary.
Well, we started the day at Tony's Bistro in Dieppe.
Then in Moncton. This is the one in Moncton East.
Well, yeah, there are two locations.
The original. They have now four. Yeah. Tony's has grown to four locations, but we are at the original location of the best croissants in Moncton.
And then we went biking along the Chocolate River to see the tidal bore. Then after, we went to Murray Beach.
We went to Murray Beach Provincial Park, and it was great to talk to the staff there about all of the increase in activity, increase in amenities, the rustic cabins that they have, the more service sites, and it was beautifully kind of quiet and a great place to hang out. Now we're here at the Bistro Le Chableur, which has been a delicious place to have lunch. Feels like an undiscovered gem, although it's been really busy, so clearly discovered by lots of folks. Next is
Les Petits Fruits de Pré d'en Haut in Memram Cook. Then we're going to do a meet and greet at the Crooked Distillery, so people can come and meet Premier Holt. And then we're going to... and the team. And we're going to finish the evening at Les Jeux de l'Acadie, a celebration of all the sport teams from all the Francophone regions.
What have you been hearing from people? I'm guessing, I know if you've been up in Murray Corner Provincial Park, one of the things you might have heard about a little is, infrastructure like highway conditions and that sort of thing and the role that plays in tourism. Have you been hearing that from people?
Yeah, we did hear that from some of the folks there and actually here at the restaurant today that we've been chatting with, that they love those assets and they want to see them showcased. And when you've got a very bumpy road that's been patched a lot of times, taking you to one of our provincial tourism assets, it maybe sends a message that we could improve.
I know that this is not like under the jurisdiction of the Minister of Tourism, although you do play a role in the prioritizing of some of these roads that get you. So how does that come across your desk? Have you heard a lot about transportation in these kind of rural areas that you're in?
Yes, we hear about it. It's a prerogative of the Department of Transport and Infrastructure, but of course I hear it as a Minister of Tourism, because as Premier said, we want to make sure that the access to the provincial parks are well entretenu, well maintained. Sorry about that.
We talk about it as a team, right? Both how you plan the scheduling of investments in infrastructure and the work. When does the work get done? Because it's the busy season for construction and tourism at the same time. And we talk about how we can schedule those things best, how we're supporting rural areas, tourism assets, and communities with their priorities, and making sure that we're listening closely to the people of the region tell us what is their priority and and that that influences what we do next.
And this is the reason why it's important to go out and see, like, for us to be on the ground and listen to people and see those infrastructures. So that's
drive the road.
So we do this touristic week, but at the same time, we can see the province from our own eyes.
I would be remiss, being from Sackville, if I didn't ask about covered bridges, because as you, I'm sure you both know, we have a beloved covered bridge that's been closed for a while, and they're so iconic, they're associated with New Brunswick. Do you think that a covered bridge kind of program is going to figure into tourism planning in the future? It seems to cross over. I mean, no, this is another infrastructure question for you, but the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure doesn't really prioritize any bridge over another bridge, but you might find a different value in them.
Yes, these are beautiful assets that our province have. We have a lot of covered bridge in New Brunswick. So, but we're hearing people again, and we know that they're it's important for them to keep them. So I'm constantly having discussions with my colleague, Minister Chuck Chiasson, Minister of DTI, and he realizes also that these are important assets for province.
Yeah, and I would add, you say that DTI treats them all like a bridge. They don't, actually, right? DTI has a process for evaluating the value of an asset, and its touristic value is included in those considerations, as well as whether it's a route that's used for economic purposes, whether it's a route to a hospital or a school, whether it's a route where vulnerable people might be a man. Like, there's lots of consideration that goes into each of the assets, and so covered bridges are absolutely considered as not just bridges, but bridges with extra value when DTI is evaluating what kind of maintenance something needs and its import and how much we're prepared to invest in it, because the covered bridges are a tourism asset. I mean, my aunt wrote a book once of drawings of covered bridges. So she has a little book of, she drew sort of pencil drawings of covered bridges all around the province and sold that book as a tourism promotion and tried to attract people to those. We're having that conversation with communities like Sackville that care very deeply for these pieces of their identity and history that we need to preserve. And so, absolutely, it's important to New Brunswickers, it's important to tourism, and it's important to us.
That's New Brunswick Premier Susan Holt and Tourism Minister Isabelle Thériault speaking with CHMA on Wednesday afternoon at Bistro Le Chable in Baie Verte.
That was Erica Butler.
Tune to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Now move to Toronto, where tens of thousands filled the streets on Sunday, June 29, for Toronto's Pride Parade, waving rainbow flags, throwing confetti and blowing bubbles. For Pride Weekend, the city closes off several blocks along Church and Yonge for local artists, street vendors, and for hundreds of floats to pass through. But in 2025, many activists reject this vision of Pride. Toronto's first ever Pride was a political march following a series of bathhouse raids. In February 1981, the Toronto police raided four bathhouses known as Operation Soap, arresting approximately 286 men. People gathered in Grange Park that year to commit to a better world for queer people in Canada. Now, some 40 years later, people are doing just that again. Toronto police cleared 13 encampments last week at Barbara Hall Park on Church Street to make space for a Pride fundraiser, which activists argued went against Pride's core principles, that is, to stand in solidarity with the most marginalized members of our community. Mia Johnson went out to that counter-protest in Grange Park on Sunday morning to hear from criminal defense lawyer Arash Gyasi and activist and journalist Desmond Cold, who demanded that police participation section in Toronto's Pride festivities be abolished for good.
I came out today because I really think that, like, the current state of policing is not what we need to keep our society much safer.
I do think there has been a little bit of ignoring of what Pride started as and the history of Pride as a movement.
We will never give up our right to take up space in these streets to demonstrate for all men.
Amid Pride celebrations this week on Church and Yonge, there were also activists who took to the streets to protest the involvement of police in Pride festivities. Pride Toronto spends just over $400,000 annually on security costs. That includes both private and paid duty police. On the morning before Toronto's Pride Parade, criminal defense lawyer Arash Ghiasi told reporters that funds should be reallocated.
A perfect example of police funding taking away from our communities happened earlier this week at the 519 Community Center, a center that is meant to serve vulnerable members of our community in Church and Wellesley area, including unhoused queer and trans people who have nowhere to stay other than at the nearby Barbara Hall Park.
Last week, Toronto police arrested four people and at least 13 encampments were removed from the park to make space for the fundraiser, a long-standing feature of Toronto Pride. The 519 declined to participate in an interview with our station, but did say the fundraiser is to raise money for queer people experiencing homelessness.
It's sad to see that Pride has turned from an opportunity to stand in solidarity with the most marginalized members of our community to an opportunity to call the police on them. We reject this vision of Pride.
Activist and journalist Desmond Cole says Pride has strayed from its roots.
To the corporate Pride that dominates the streets of Toronto every year has, I think, completely lost the focus of what Pride began as, which was a riot against policing, which was a struggle by queer and trans people to be able to be safe in our own streets. And we're at a time now in 2025 when the organizers of Toronto Pride are telling us that because of policing and security costs, they're, you know, in danger of being able to run their own events. So I think that this is a really important contrast. We don't invite the police to our celebration. We don't cooperate with the police. We use this opportunity every year to talk about the first Pride demonstrations, to talk about bathhouse raids, to talk about Marie Curtis Park and undercover police investigations, to entrap queer people cruising in parks, and to say that, like, those realities are still with us today.
Cole helped lead the march Sunday, where we caught up with him, starting in Grange Park, where over 100 protesters were in attendance, boycotting the city's celebrations.
So it's not time for us to wave a rainbow flag or shoot a water gun with the cops. It's time for us to continue fighting for our liberation.
This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
The Transportation Agency of Metro Vancouver, called TransLink, recently announced an unusual collaboration with a beer company. Patina Brewing, located in British Columbia, partnered with TransLink to release a public transit-themed craft beer, the Platform Pilsner. Why, you might ask? Well, while this is a novel collaboration, it's one that TransLink hopes is able to inspire other unique collaborations with local businesses, generating new sources of revenue. To learn more about this unusual association between TransLink and the Patina Brewing, journalist Danny Nesvadarani reached out to John Jang, TransLink's media relations advisor.
It's a really, really good question. So first of all, you know, TransLink as an organization, we're always trying to think of new ways, creative ways to generate a little bit of revenue that doesn't involve us having to increase the fares for customers. And with that in mind, our CP&P team, which is our corporate partnerships and program team, they essentially are tasked with coming up with creative ways to find other organizations, businesses, or opportunities to find these revenue streams. As another example, I'll mention that we introduced Amazon lockers on TransLink SkyTrain stations and transit hubs a couple of years back, again, to also realize that customers could use this as a benefit. When you're working and going to school, you want to pick up a package along the way home. It's really convenient, to do it right at your SkyTrain station or transit hub. So they kind of came to us and said, hey, we have this idea of a partnership with Patina, and we think it'd be a really great way to do it. And I just immediately thought, well, that seems like an excellent idea. Let's see what we can do. And so we were able to partner with Patina and license the intellectual property for TransLink and kind of work together to create the platform Pilsner. It's, I think, the first of its kind program, not just in Canada, but possibly in North America, when you think about a transit agency doing something like this. So we were really proud of the fact that it's kind of progressive. And come on, let's be real. Metro Vancouver is known for a lot of different things, including a very strong craft beer scene.
Later on, we asked him if this collaboration opens the door for other TransLink-themed products, whether that be a TransLink sneaker or any other array of TransLink food items or specialty drinks like the one that's seen in this collaboration with Patina Brewing.
You know what? I guess never say never. I don't know that anything is in the works for a TransLink sneaker, though that would be a pretty cool idea. Obviously, if a sneaker head is listening right now, I'm sure they'd love that. But for us, again, it's just trying to find creative ways to generate a little bit of that revenue. So the Amazon partnership with the lockers, again, being a really good example of us doing something like that. Obviously, it's not like a TransLink locker. It's still an Amazon branded locker. Amazon is the one that provides those lockers. We just give them the space and the lease to do it. But it gives us a little bit of money where if we hadn't done that partnership, we wouldn't be getting that money. And all of that money still goes to support and fund operational services across Metro Vancouver. So, you know, I think if you've got other brilliant ideas like TransLink sneakers, TransLink snacks, food, nothing is off the table as long as it makes sense for us as an organization, for our customers, and also for the organizations that we'd be partnering with. It's basically the task of having to come up with all these different creative ways to generate a little bit of revenue. And I would say, like, there's never too little. Like, any bit that we can get through programs like the collaboration with Patina Brewing, it just goes to help everyone, whether it's us having to keep the services or the customers who depend on having those services every single day.
Thanks to Danny Nesvanarani.
Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
From British Columbia, we now move back to Montreal to catch up with a group of bat watchers. In Montreal's borough of Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, NDG if you prefer, there's a group of researchers and community members who go out at night to listen to the sounds of bats. The event is called Bat Walks, and the first bat walk of the year took place on the evening of June 26. The bat walkers record bat sounds using wildlife acoustic technology. These sensitive microphones are able to isolate sounds too high-pitched for human ears. The bat walks are run by the group Finding Urban Nature, or FUN, a partnership between a charity group called Urban Nature Education in NDG and Concordia University's Biology Department. FUN leads public talks, tours, and other events to help get citizens engaged with urban nature. Adam Innes in Montreal.
You've heard of bird watchers, but how about bat watchers? Here in NDG, there is a group of researchers and community members who go out at night and pick up the sounds of bats. They're called bat walks, and the first bat walk of the year took place on the evening of June 26th. This is the sound of a bat recorded near Terry Fox Park along Rue Saint-Jacques. This sound was gathered using wildlife acoustic technology. Sensitive microphones are able to isolate sounds too high-pitched for human ears. The bat walks are run by a group called Finding Urban Nature, or FUN, a partnership between the charity group Urban Nature Education and Concordia's Biology Department. Fun leads public talks, tours, and other events to help get citizens engaged with urban nature.
I think kids generally understand it with just kind of as a basic treasure hunt in their own community to find a new thing that they didn't know about before. And I think everyone is a kid at some level that comes out here to learn what more there is in their community, in their daily life, that they might not have noticed before. And once you've noticed them, it's hard to unnotice them.
That was Fun's director, Karen Fisher-Favre. She was out with the team of students and community members. The people on the bat walks are given wildlife acoustic microphones attached to iPads. These pick up the sounds of the bats, as members of Fun explain the importance of bats in the area.
The main ecosystem service that these bats provide to our community is really reducing the number of insects. So a bat can eat up to 1,000 insects an hour in the middle of summer, and the nursing females get up to 4,000 an hour.
The group is in its third year running the bat walks. Here's Concordia researcher Ashley Spanier-Levasse talking about some of the bats they've seen on these walks.
We've mainly seen big brown bats, silver-haired bats, and hoary bats. Occasionally, mostly down by the water, we've gotten eastern red bats. Sometimes a tricolored bat will appear, and there's been a few really random ones that we're not very confident in have reappeared.
In addition to bat walks for public education, the Concordia researchers here are also studying what are called flight corridors, examining the paths that bats take through the skies so that cities can plan development without disturbing the winged animals. I'm Adam Innes.
I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoint.
And our last stop will be in Winnipeg this week, where we meet up with Ryan Funk, who was on location when the new fire and paramedic station in Windsor Park officially opened its doors to the public last week. The first thing you notice, he says, when you walk into the station is how open everything is. It was all by design, says Deputy Chief Tom Wallace, who explains that this was to feel more inviting for the community and for the nearby schools and students who could just look out and see first responders and maybe, who knows, get inspired. Ryan Funk.
It's to invite them in to see what we do, but to work towards being part of the community that we serve. One of our attendees at the commissioning ceremony last week highlighted the fact that when our staff are working out in the fitness room upstairs, there's a school right across the street. So the kids who are on the playground can look up and see what the firefighters and paramedics are doing, and perhaps see themselves in a career in emergency services.
At its core, the station reflects a shift towards localized, integrated training. It houses a multi-purpose classroom space that doubles as a meeting area, playing a key role in Winnipeg's hazardous material or HAZMAT response program. This station is also equipped to provide on-site HAZMAT training. Deputy Chief Wallace says this reduces the need to send crews across town to other facilities, keeping vital emergency resources closer to the community they serve. The location was also a carefully considered decision.
So years ago, when we were in the project initiation phase for this project, we had to start by identifying a location. And there was a lot of interest in that time at locating this facility closer to Lagimodier, with the idea that you could quickly get north or south. But in doing some reading on best practices, we found that you really need to locate the facility and the resources where your calls for service are.
After studying the locations from which calls for medical and fire services were coming, 1083 Ottomwood Drive was chosen. Deputy Chief Wallace says that it was right in the middle of the calls, so emergency services could more safely, effectively, and efficiently respond to them.
As members of the Winnipeg Fire Paramedic Service, we are public servants first and foremost, and we want the public to know that that is our primary role, is serving the public. But again, as I say, our interest with this facility is also to be a part of the community, to be an inviting space.
Deputy Chief Wallace adds that with their classroom space, it will also be able to have public education and fire prevention staff deliver programming directly from the new facility.
I mean, if you look at this corner, we've got two schools, we've got churches here, we've got local businesses. These are all, there's a real potential there, I think, for improving service delivery.
Public visibility and support were just part of the design priorities, with efficiency the other. The hose tower also serves as a decontamination room, and an air bottle filling station helps crews refill gear without leaving their area. Fast opening bifold doors speed up response time, while clean gear storage, showers, and laundry reduce health risks. It's also the city's first building with geothermal heating and cooling, and is estimated to cut emissions by 98.6% compared to other buildings its size. These decisions are being used as a benchmark for other projects across Winnipeg.
So we have three projects that are in the planning stages right now for stations elsewhere within the city. We're taking lessons learned from this facility and feedback from our staff and the public about what they would like to see in those projects, and trying to incorporate that feedback into those projects at this early phase.
The space also utilized materials from the old station, creating outdoor benches and the kitchen table from the reclaimed wood. Deputy Chief Wallace notes that this ties the past to the future and their continued commitment to serve the community. I'm Ryan Funk.
With this, we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalist Ryan Funk, Danny Nesvadarani, Erica Butler, Mia Johnson, and Adam Innes. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. It was a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and to your radio station for giving us a voice. And until the next one, take care. Ciao.